Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the founder and host, and tonight we'll be continuing our exploration of how our spirituality, our inner worlds in some ways, I guess, our inner resources, can in many ways make good on their promise and actually help us rise to the challenges of what I think is not just a series of random crises, but an evolutionary emergency. And to do that, we'll be talking with evolutionary evangelist Michael Dowd. As many of you already know, I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how our inner worlds can shift and catalyze a time in which we come forward and rise to the challenges of particularly turbulent times and go through what may be an epochal transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet, which is obviously not just a matter of engineering, but also of cultural transformation. And in the interest of this, we've had a whole series of profound and edgy and enlightening conversations in which we've focused on many specific aspects of this question. And this morning, I am happy to be going into a dialogue that Michael creatively chose to entitle Big Integrity, Deep Time Eyes, and a Global Heart. Michael Dowd is an itinerant evolutionary evangelist of religious naturalism. He's the author of Thank God for Evolution, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World, which was endorsed by 6 Nobel laureates and other science luminaries, including some noted skeptics, and by religious leaders across the spectrum from conservative to liberal. And since 2002, Michael has traveled North America with his wife, Connie Barlow, who's a noted science writer in her own right. And together they've addressed more than 1,200 religious and secular audiences. And their work really focuses on showing how the science-based epic of physical, biological, and cultural evolution, which is really our common creation story, how it can be interpreted in ways that inspire people to cooperate across religious and political differences in service of a just and thriving future for all people in the whole natural world. And they show how an understanding of human nature given by evolutionary psychology and brain science can help each of us live with greater integrity and more passion for life. Michael was originally trained as an evangelist, essentially. His BA was from Evangel University. He has a Master's of Divinity from Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary. And his great passion is showing people of all backgrounds and beliefs how scientific, historical, and cross-cultural evidence can be understood as if in the same way as divine revelation, you know, as directly experienced as divine guidance, and that this can provide a rock-solid foundation for a life of joy and meaningful service. His recent popular online teleseries, The Advent of Evolutionary Christianity, explored the embrace of evolution by a wide range of Christian leaders, teachers, and practitioners. Something I love about Michael is his joyful, hearty, playful, and ecstatic embrace of the natural world. He and Connie, like me, immerse themselves in lakes and rivers and oceans and creeks year-round and delight in the wonder and beauty of the natural world in a playful, innocent, and very alive way. Something I'm particularly charmed by is that Michael and Connie nicknamed our beloved North American continent Nora. And we both agree, Nora is an amazing beauty with whom we are utterly in love. So I'm so happy to welcome you this morning, Michael, as my guest. I'm so happy you're here.
Oh, thanks, Terry. I must say that was one of my favorite introductions of all time, especially all that good personal stuff toward the end. It's a delight to be here.
Oh, great. You know, you thought it would be good to title this dialogue Big Integrity. And I wanted to ask you, you know, what you mean by that? What defines a right relationship to reality in your view?
Yeah. Well, actually, before I even go there, what I want to say to you, Terry, is how much I personally appreciate, and many of us who are in the realm of spirituality or spiritual practice or, you know, working with religious or spiritual communities, that what you're doing and what Craig Hamilton and others are doing in terms of really furthering the edge of the Eastern, more Eastern Enlightenment spiritual tradition, in terms of really a wholehearted, full-bodied, full-minded embrace of evolution, is just, I just think it's really, really important. So it's a delight to be able to talk from, Avi sort of representing the evidential tradition, the tradition, if you want to call it that, of science. And what I mean by big integrity is being in right relationship to reality, given our best current global collective intelligence about the nature of reality. Human beings have always had collective intelligence at whatever scale we've organized ourselves at that time. When we lived tribally, we had tribal collective intelligence, and then regional, and then when we started living in cities and so on. And we're now at a time in history where the two fundamental questions that all societies, all religions, all spiritual paths have necessarily had to deal with, namely, what's real and what's important? Or as philosopher of religion Loyal Roux says, how things are and which things matter. And all philosophies, all spiritualities have had a model, a map, if you will, of how things are and which things matter, what's real and what's important. And if we're not operating on our current collective, best collective intelligence in terms of what's real, how things are, then we will necessarily have a skewed or inadequate or perhaps even dysfunctional understanding of what's important. And so big integrity is, I'm using the word integrity as right relationship to reality at all scales. And it means coming into right relationship to reality. And of course, that's something that's determined not just by an individual, but we collectively, like, for example, the nature of reality, the reason that we know that we live in a 13.72 billion year universe, the reason that we know that the Atlantic Ocean came into existence because of tectonic plates, and that's what causes tsunamis and earthquakes. The reason we know all this isn't because of any one individual. It's the collective enterprise, the global human enterprise that we call science, that's simply global collective intelligence at this time. Many religious people have deeply valued and held in their heart, and they find as sacred, more ancient maps of what's real and what's important. We're at this really difficult time in human history when many religious traditions are out of step with our current best understanding of what's real. And so, for example, it's not a surprise that, you know, a third of Americans, let me say this, it's not a surprise that America is not leading the world with regards to our response to climate change, because one in three Americans believe these are the end times anyway, so why bother? So our worldviews matter, and so big integrity is really developing deep time eyes, that is an evidential understanding of time, not just a mythic understanding of time, and an evidential understanding of nature, both the outer nature and our inner nature, our own psyches, our own being, our own, you know, brains, our own sort of inner proclivities, and death. And I think those are the three major things that every religion, every spirituality has had to deal with, and in fact did a good job of dealing with, in terms of helping people have a relationship to the past, a relationship to the present, and a relationship to a potential future, that is a relationship to time, that was honorable, a relationship to death that was honorable, and a relationship to nature, both our inner nature and our outer nature, that was honorable. The problem is we're now in a time when most religious people, and I'm saying it bold like that, most religious people have a dishonoring view of time, a dishonoring view of nature, and a dishonoring view of death. And it's not because we're bad, it's just because we've inherited those, because we've held those traditions sacred. And so I think we're just in an incredibly exciting time where all the religious traditions are finding some way to accommodate themselves to science, to what's being revealed through evidence, through scientific evidence, cross-cultural evidence, and historic evidence. And I think, frankly, it's going to be the best thing for religion, because I don't think religions are going to die out. unless you interpret religion as just supernatural otherworldlyism, I think that will probably die out in the next 100, 150 years. But I think in terms of religion being in right relationship to reality, understood that way, and spirituality or spiritual practices being the practices, the exercises that lead us to being in right relationship to reality, I think we're going to see an explosion you might even call it a revival coming from the Western tradition of spirituality, but it's a spiritual naturalism. It's a this world rather than otherworldly or afterlife oriented spirituality.
That's very it's interesting, Michael. There's a couple different directions I'm intrigued to go with you. I guess I'll hold myself back. My work in some ways kind of comes up here because it's very much a rational and empirical, we call it sometimes post-metaphysical approach to spirituality, and I want to bring that in. But first, I think I want to bring this back to the kind of core question that we're asking. So are you then saying that this evidential-based relationship to the story of evolution can create a transformation of religion such that it bridges the culture gaps and culture wars and enables us to come together in a new way? Is that how you see it? Is your activism really about creating a kind of healing? I mean, in some ways it seems as though the people are digging in and almost more and more embittered. It's hard to see evidence of the culture wars waning. How do you see this work you're doing concretely contributing in, you know, in the next, you know, in your lifetime, in our, you know, in the time that we're operating? How is it going to make a critical difference that's going to register at the scale of the kinds of problems we're facing as a species?
Yeah, great question. Well, just to back up, I mean, Connie and I have been living on the road for 9 years. That's all we do is we permanently travel North America. I did the calculation the other day. We've spoken to 1,550 groups. Of all different ages, all different sizes, all different backgrounds, from devoutly religious groups of all different kinds to non-religious and anti-religious groups. And I think the answer to your question is one of the reasons why this perspective, this evidential science-based sacred evolutionary perspective has been embraced by all different kinds of religious and non-religious groups, is because it provides a common creation story. It provides a story that allows us to see us all as related. I mean, when each tribe had its story of how things are and which things matter. And it was a mythic story. It was a story full of day and night language. What I mean by night language is the kind of thing that happens in our dreams. But, you know, when you fly in your dreams, you're not having a supernatural experience. You're having an experience that's common to the dream state. And so all stories, tribal stories, and then as we've gone throughout history, cooperating at ever larger scale, we've had stories that helped us see that we could cooperate at a larger scale than what our genes were going to lead us to cooperate, which is our families and clans and those with whom we could have a reciprocal cooperative relationship. And so stories have been what facilitated that. But now we're in a place where we're globally interconnected economically, technologically. And yet, if we don't have a story that unites us, that helps us see that we are related to all creatures and all other humans, and that, in fact, our differences are minuscule. One of my favorite quotes from Marlon Lavanar, he's a pastor of one of the largest churches, I think the largest church in the Unitarian Universalist Association in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he says, you know, we've all heard some fundamentalist-minded person say, don't tell me I'm related to monkeys. But now that we understand DNA and have cracked its code, we know that we're not just related to monkeys. We're related to zucchini, so let's get over it. That sense of our profound relatedness to the stars, that our bodies are literally made of atoms that were forged in the bellies or the hearts of stars before they died, or just in the dying phase, in the red giant and supernova phase. And we don't believe this. We know this. This is what – there's not a cosmologist on the planet that would disagree with that. We know that we're genetically related to all of life. And so I think that big history, the academic discipline of big history, which is the history of everyone and everything, it's physical evolution, biological evolution, and cultural evolution as humanity's common creation story. That story, the big history story, or the epic of evolution as humanity's common story, is what allows us to cherish our differences, on sort of metaphysical or religious or spiritual sorts of language and concepts and practices. We can cherish those differences. We don't have to convert each other on those differences, but it gives us a story that allows us to see that we're all part of one human family, that humans are in fact the universe after some 14 billion years of unbroken evolution, that finally the universe in this solar system became complex enough that the universe could begin to contemplate its own nature. And that's who we are. Humans are literally the universe after some 13.7 billion years of unbroken, you know, creativity now reflecting on itself. And so that sense of our connectedness, our relatedness, and that our story, our history goes deep, and our relatedness goes deep, and our sense of self goes deep, that myself doesn't stop with my skin. As Alan Watts called it, the skin-encapsulated ego. Myself includes the larger body of life. It includes you. It includes the universe. That's my larger self. It's called the greening of the self, or the expansion of the self, which is not the same thing as the sort of overcoming of the self or the annihilation of the self. It's not that at all. It's an expansion. So I think that this big history, this epic of evolution as humanity's common creation story, is what will facilitate, and what is already beginning to facilitate, huge cooperation across ethnic, political, religious, and other differences. It also gives me a profound sense of hope in the future when I see these long-term trends that have been at work for, in some cases, billions of years, but in some cases only a few hundred years.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I find the story of evolution to be just tremendously moving and inspiring and spiritually potent in ways that are really it's impossible to do justice to just how profound that is, this awakening to I like to use the phrase the whole human and non-human family, that deep connectedness that we have that extends not just to the whole living world, but ultimately, even beyond that, you know, this sense that, you know, that we are ancient stardust. This whole idea of zooming back as far as it takes to a deep time perspective, which is mind blowing. To think in terms of to think that Isaac Newton, who was one of the most hard headed evidence based thinkers we've ever had, believed the whole Earth was only 4,000 years old. That our concept of ancient kind of exhausts itself at the beginning of recorded human history, and that's only what maybe 5,000 years in length. That is what our intuitive sense of ancient is, and yet we're dealing with a species that is, depending on how you count it, 100,000 to maybe a million, or at the long end, 5 million years old, and a planet that is 5 billion years old, and a universe that's 13.7 billion years old. To think in terms of those, it stretches the imagination beyond limits, and then beyond those limits, it opens us to a kind of wonder and awe. It can be a source of ecstasy, maybe a source of inspiration, maybe a source of strength, maybe a source of purpose and dignity, and a sense of serving something greater than ourselves. And out of that, perhaps we can act for the common good. Maybe are you thinking then that part of your work is to awaken some of the qualities of that are celebrated in the religious communities as virtues like hope and faith and service and maybe even repentance in people who are already evidence-based but perhaps live less rich inner lives?
Not quite. I mean, what we're trying to do, what Connie and I are trying to do, is really show people that, you know, if you want to have profound mystical states of oneness and transcendence and communion with the divine, you know, there's a tremendous amount that the traditions have to offer in terms of practices on how to do that. But in the 21st century, given this reality now, if you want a fabulous life, if you want like a, you know, just a kick butt life, you know, if you want the peace that passes all understanding on this side of death, if you want to live completely guilt-free, resentment-free, you know, free of fear, if you want thriving relationships, you know, with your parents, with your kids, with your neighbors, with your coworkers. You know, relationships that you and they would rate as an 8 to 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. If you want that kind of stuff, traditional wisdom, textual wisdom, and even transmitted wisdom is inadequate. The only approach is an evidential-based approach, because we actually have a lot of evidence on how to have a kick-ass life, how to have thriving relationships, how to die peacefully and serenely, and you know, and how to leave a sweet legacy. We now know evidentially a lot about that, and yet for many religious people and spiritual people, their focus is still on sort of traditional spiritual practices, which are great if they're seen as a means to an end. But if they're seen as an end in themselves, and the means to the end being right relationship to reality. You know, I mean, you can frankly meditate until your legs won't move, you know. But if you know, your relationship to your brother or your mother or your sister sucks, then you're not going to experience the kind of freedom that's possible. If you just simply learn the very practical tools, the habits, the skills for how to thrive in right relationship to reality. And so one of the things I'm trying to do, and one of the things Connie and I are trying to do, is show people that an evidential approach to spirituality, and perhaps even spirituality is not the right word, an evidential approach to a science, let's put this, the science of living a mythic, meaningful life, doesn't compete with any existing religious or traditional or spiritual or metaphysical approach. It's meta-religious. It's meta-metaphysical. It's meta-spiritual. It's, you know, it can feed and nourish any and all religious traditions. But in fact, if you're a part of any religious tradition that's existing, Catholicism, Protestantism, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, Shintoism, Taoism, you know, it doesn't matter. And you haven't really learned what science is now telling us in terms of our best evidential understanding of nature, including your own nature, your own inner nature, time and death. For example, that death is essential in the universe, that I'm talking about that if it weren't for the death of stars, there would be no periodic table of elements. If it weren't for the death of plants and animals, there would be no food, and so on. If you don't have your best evidential understanding, it's not just difficult, it's impossible to truly honor time, death, and nature. And that's what I see now as, you know, one of the things I love about the subtitle of this series that you're doing is the future of spiritual practice. I see this future of spiritual practice as an honoring relationship, a deeply honoring relationship to time, nature, including your own nature, and death. And I think that's the growing edge of all spiritual practice and all spirituality, because frankly, that's what unites us. I mean, it doesn't matter what your religious tradition or philosophical background, if you have an honoring stance towards your inner and outer nature, towards death, and towards the past, the present, and our responsibility for a healthy future, you're going to have an amazing life, and you're going to thrive. And so that any and all spiritual practices, your meditation practice or anything else, is like spice on a really delicious, yummy, nutritious meal.
That's great. One of the questions that comes up for me as I feel into what you're offering there is very different disposition that I experience when I see dialogues, at least with certain skeptics, some of the new atheists. The mood of the inquiry leans into knowledge and to focusing on what we know and what we have evidence for and being only interested in that, whereas the mood among spiritual practitioners, even those who are quite rational and who don't necessarily posit metaphysical beliefs that are rooted in ancient systems, is more focused on a sense of wonder and a sense of interest in what we don't know and what it is that, you know, the mystery is more the focus of attention. And without that sense of the mystery, I wonder if I guess what I tend to feel is a kind of psychological and you might call it psycho-spiritual imbalance. There's a potential for a kind of focus only on where we have power over nature and not a communion with the larger reality that we're part of the fabric of, and therefore a focus on what we can know rather than a presence to what we could never know, and therefore a kind of opening of the being in relation to that. And I know you're trying to bridge this gap. How do you work with that particular territory in your own interpretation of things?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, first of all, let me sort of defend my less spiritually or less religiously oriented colleagues just for a moment, because I think that oftentimes we who are part of the religious or spiritual communities, look at the new atheists or humanists or secularists as, sort of the way you've just characterized. And I think that's both inaccurate and unfortunate, because I think that at least certainly most of the skeptics and humanists and atheists that I know are reacting to a supernatural otherworldlyism as though that's what's really real or really important. I think what they're reacting to is the fact you've got billions of religious people operating with a very ancient map of reality, or I should say ancient maps of reality, and so they have skewed senses of what's important, and so they're attacking that. And I have a sort of an ecosystems approach to diversity. I actually think that we need a wide diversity, and so I'm personally grateful for what the new atheists are doing, even though I'm trying to do something very different in a larger body of life. So to come back to your question, yes, I am trying to bridge this. Connie and I are both trying to bridge this. Our main website is thegreatstory.org, and it's the leading website in the big history or epic of evolution or religious naturalism movement, meaning that everything that's there can be used by Christians or Buddhists or Hindus or Jews or atheists. You know, it's non-metaphysical, it's non-religious, but it can nourish and feed any religious or metaphysical perspective because it's grounded in evidence. And to your question about the known and the unknown and the mystery, and a lot of people do find where they find God or the holy or the sacred or the deeply inspirational is in the mystery. And that's cool. That's great. That's often been traditionally the case. And part of that is because most of history, we didn't frankly have knowledge. We didn't have any measurable knowledge in terms of the nature of reality. Where we came from, how old are things, how did that mountain get there, how did that ocean get there, what are we made of, and what's that big ball of fire up in the sky that heats us? All these big questions were answered in mythic ways. What gets called supernatural, but it's actually pre-natural, if you tried to describe how the sun moved across the sky 500 years ago or 600 years ago, you would have had a so-called supernatural story that explained it, but it wouldn't have been supernatural. It was pre-natural. It was before we could have possibly had a natural understanding. And so I tend to bow and appreciate those who, for whom the mystery or the divine or the sense of holy is found in the mystery. That's great. I'm an evolutionary mystic myself. But what Connie and I are passionately trying to do is show people that equally the divine or the holy or the sacred or the deeply inspirational or deeply meaningful can also be found in the known. And because a lot of people think of the known in a mere secular way. Oh, that's just secular knowledge. That's just knowledge. And so they really value the unknown, the uncertain. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. But if that means a disvaluing or a dishonoring of what we know, and what we can measure, and what we can experience with our senses, not just in our hearts and our minds, then I think problems arise. And so, I see sort of science, the whole world of what we know, is like an island. I got this analogy from somebody else. I don't remember who it was. But, everything that we know is like an island in a sea of mystery. And the more we learn, the more the island grows. And it's growing. And it's growing substantially. But in the larger context of things, no matter how large that island gets, it doesn't significantly depreciate or lessen, the sea of mystery. But what it does do is it increases the shoreline. It increases where the known intersects with what we don't know. And I think that's one of the biggest shifts that an evolutionary spirituality or an evolutionary integrity gets us, which is that we used to have this understanding that the more we learn, the more we you know, the less there would be that we don't know, the less mystery. And I think that's not the case. I think the more we learn, the more we know that we don't know. And so I'm frankly interested in, this is what I try to do in our Kindness in My programs, is show people, yes, continue to value and find the sacred in the mystery and in the unknown. That's cool. That's great. But let's also find it in the known and in what's natural. That's why my focus is less on the metaphysical than on the physical. It's less on the supernatural than the natural, because I think the natural is sacred. The physical is sacred.
I totally resonate with everything you're affirming, and I'm also feeling that there is a something that comes down to ideas that I know you've worked with a lot in your religious education. For instance, the idea that we are here in service of something greater than ourselves, and it's when we feel turned to that with a sense of awe and a sense of a kind of heartful surrender and connectedness that we are experienced by one another as morally trustworthy, and there's a potential for us to come together in a much richer way. And I've often felt with you know, because I have quite a few good friends who are more materialistic or skeptical in their orientation. And often it's that quantity that I'm wishing for more from them as individuals, that if I could feel their open hearts in love and service of something greater than themselves, in which they were interested to join together with others, rather than a quality that's more knowing and arrogant and dismissive and kind of scornful of those qualities in others, it would seem that they could be much more effective fellow citizens in a broader coming together. I mean, it's those qualities that I sometimes see as among the most essential aspects of what spirituality does give us. Because clearly we need new qualities of inner resource to rise to the challenges of a very turbulent period of time that we're already in and which seems likely to intensify. And those inner resources that are sometimes brought forward so powerfully by our spiritual practices and by our intuition of a greater unknowable reality can be the ingredients for us to feel a kind of fellowship and connectedness to one another. And I guess I hold a kind of hope to see that kind of generosity of spirit across a broader spectrum. And that's the element that feels often deficient among the more materialistic and skeptical folks. You obviously, you know, you hang with them a lot more actively and professionally, you know, than I do. And maybe you can help me open into a different view. What am I missing?
Well, Terry, first of all, I appreciate the question and the humility behind it. But I'm not a believer. I'm not a religious believer. I mean, I would be counted among the skeptics, meaning as someone who's skeptical of supernatural or metaphysical claims. You know, I want to ask, what evidence do you have for that? And I have not found that the majority of humanists and skeptics and atheists and science-oriented people don't have a concern for humility, compassion, generosity, a commitment to something larger than themselves or anything else. They do tend to be hard, especially some of the more vocal out new atheists, they do tend to be hard on religionists, and I think, frankly, for some good reasons. But my inclination, certainly on this call, is to less focus on that, because my hunch is that probably 90% or more of your listeners, both those listening now live and those that listen later, are coming from more of a spiritual and metaphysical and heartful and, you know, traditional sort of orientation. And so I'd rather, if I could, shift to where I see some of the greatest possibilities, the greatest opportunities, and also some of the greatest challenges within the spiritual communities. I think it has to do with what we began touching on just a little bit ago, which is that, you know, one of my great mentors, Thomas Berry, said, you know, good people are dangerous when they're operating out of a sense of good that's not in alignment with reality. In other words, if they're operating out of an ancient map of reality, you know, good people can be dangerous. We see that all around us in this culture, people who say they're doing something for good reasons or because their religious tradition is compelling them to do it, and yet, you know, it's obvious to others that what they're doing isn't as good as they think it is. And, you know, I could say, you know, spiritual people, if what they mean by spiritual is basically just meditation and prayer and sort of these more inner disciplines, but if their spirituality doesn't include cleaning up their wake, if it doesn't include honoring their own instincts, the fact that we all have an unchosen nature, we all have inherited proclivities, you know, we have instincts like all other animals do, yet our instincts didn't evolve to serve the needs that we, you know, to serve us in this kind of a world. Our instincts evolved to serve the survival and reproduction needs of our ancestors in a world that we don't live in anymore. And that mismatch of our instincts in a world where we are surrounded by what's called supernormal stimuli, we're surrounded with a concentration of food-like items that aren't in fact food, and substances and activities that we are evolutionarily programmed to want and to want more of and to want more of. And so having mismatched instincts in a world of supernormal stimuli, if we don't honor that, if we can't find gratitude for the fact that you and I wouldn't be having this conversation if some of our ancestors, in fact, of all of our ancestors, hadn't had the very same instincts that we sometimes can find challenging living in a modern or postmodern world, that gratitude allows us to have compassion for ourselves, a lightness for ourselves, a humor, and an appreciation. And it's like, you know, that old adage, what you resist persists. Well, what you can be grateful for can transform. And it's an evolutionary witness. It's a witness capacity that comes not from sitting on a cushion and noticing your thoughts and feelings. It can only come from science. It can only come from an evidential understanding, an evidentially a knowledge-based understanding of why we have the feelings that we have. That our feelings make really good evolutionary sense, including our troubling feelings. That our inherited proclivity, that our temptations to do this or to do that or to not do this or to see this or to go here or to do, these temptations that we find problematic and challenging and that we constantly see ourselves at war at, when we can have appreciation, we can relax, we have a lightness, you know, and it no longer has power over us. But it's a witness capacity that can only come from an evidential understanding. It's an evolutionary witness. And so I think that for those who are listening in on this conversation, I guess my invitation would be, keep doing whatever your spiritual practice is. That's great. But I would encourage you, you know, to make time on a daily basis. You know, maybe it's 15 minutes a day. Maybe it's a half hour a day. But to really begin to learn what is our best evidential understanding of human nature. Because when you do that, you're going to have a lightness and a humility and a laughter and a playfulness towards your own things that 2 months ago you were struggling with, and all of a sudden now you don't struggle with because you now have an evolutionary witness that you couldn't have had if you didn't have the knowledge. And also an evolutionary compassion for others, because you look around, you see others struggling with their own inherited proclivities, their own unchosen nature, and you can begin to lighten up about it. So I would say, growing in our evidential understanding and evidential honoring, again, coming back to that term honor, to honor our instincts, to honor the nature within us and the nature around us, to honor time. And frankly, I mean, one of the things that I see in spiritual communities all over is a dishonoring of time. There's so much emphasis on the present moment that we don't take time to learn big history. We don't take time to learn some of the broad stroke. I'm not talking about all the details of evolution, but I'm talking about some of the broad strokes of big history where we can find ourselves literally weeping with gratitude for the fact that millions of our ancestors, human and non-human, lived their lives and suffered and died, and if they didn't, we wouldn't be alive. But if we don't know that, we're going to be clueless. It's like we're autistic or we've, you know, got amnesia. And when we learn it, we can have this gratitude that can wash over us And it's a gratitude that can only come if we evidentially know our story. And then finally, death. If we don't have an honoring of death, so many religious and spiritual people so focused on the afterlife, the other world, the transcendent realm. And I think that can do us a great injustice. I pastored 3 churches over the course of about a decade. And some of the people that struggled most when they were given a terminal diagnosis were some of the most religious and spiritual people, because they had frankly been putting off even thinking about death. Even though they had elaborate theologies and philosophies and metaphysics about what happened to them after death, they still hadn't cleaned that stuff up with their brother or their sister or their mother. They hadn't told people that they were grateful for, that they really were. They hadn't done the work that becomes natural when you befriend death, when you really honor the fact that we all live this one life and we all die in a physical sense. That's real. And when we befriend death, and as you know, I was forced to do this in a very personal way because I was diagnosed 1.5 years ago with a very threatening form of cancer. And I'm hugely grateful for that opportunity to, fortunately now, the last test that I've had didn't show any kind of cancer, but there was a period of about a month where I thought I could die really soon. And that process of allowing me to look at my life and asking myself, if I die a month from now, what do I want to do or say between now and then? And I realized one of the things that was really important to me was having no secrets, having no resentments, and having no unfinished business. And for me, that's what heaven is. Heaven, on this side of death, heaven is living free, completely free of guilt, resentments, or fear, and with such a trust and such a sense of reverence and honoring of time, death, and nature that I don't have to die to go to heaven. I experience it now, here in this life. And I think that's where the growing edge is for us religious and spiritual people, is to really have an honoring view of nature, death, and time, and our own instincts. And I think, at least from my vantage point, that's the leading edge or the future of spiritual practice. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so grateful that you are doing what you're doing, and Craig Hamilton and others are doing what they're doing, and what all these thought leaders in my Evolutionary Christianity program were doing for the Christian tradition, is really taking our best evidential understanding and beginning to transform the religious traditions in light of it.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I very much resonate with this this world, the beautiful testimony that you gave from your heart, particularly after your confrontation with your own cancer diagnosis, about your sources of inspiration that are entirely this worldly, and the desire to simply live a life of integrity and without regrets, without guilt, shame, without secrets, the kind of high integrity existence, and that is a kind of heaven on earth in a very real way. That touches my heart. I think for me, and I know that you do this, Michael, you and Connie both embody this in your lives. Another thing that would be important to mention is that sense of being in service to this larger evolutionary process that we are not just the eyes of evolution, but you might say the hands of evolution in our time, and that cultural evolution, as different as that might be from biological evolution, is going to determine the future of biological evolution on this planet, at least for the human species and many of the other higher species. And so we really are this very same thing that has been moving toward more complexity and interconnectedness and intentionality and consciousness for 13.7 billion years, and that very force that said yes in the Big Bang is there in my heart wanting to make a contribution, and that sense of meaning and purpose is tremendously central. But for me, it does also connect to the ancient point of spirituality, that dropping out of the fixation of my attention in the mind and a certain band of emotions and opening to the full functional capacities of the human brain and nervous system, in which a deep intuition of a profound spaciousness, an activation of awareness of what I call the subtle and causal levels of being, in which the essentially loving nature of existence is directly experienced in my own nervous system, the essentially peaceful and caring and appreciative and kind of radiant nature of it all, so that sometimes when I'm in my highest states of consciousness, a kind of loving goodness bubbles forth out of my being spontaneously, and I can resonate with some of the kinds of truths that, that some of my other guests have said, I think probably most eloquently and simply by Ram Dass, even though he, you know, he's had a stroke and he speaks haltingly, just saying, be love, that the love that we are kind of are at essence and being that, you know, a lot comes from that. So that for me, there are kind of two principles, I'd say, one that is timeless and one that is evolutionary, and that we don't need to prefer one to another, that the embrace of both really defines my spiritual practice, and that the awakenings that occur through a whole life that is significantly given over to that which transcends the normal focus of attention ennobles and uplifts me and awakens me to a greater reality and identity in a way that make me more trustable and more capable of being a citizen of a cultural in transition that can become a healthy human adaptive response to this crisis moment in our evolutionary process. And for me, the classical, so-called classical enlightenment side is not less central to that than the evolutionary side. That for, you know, there's an embrace of both that's at the core of things. Even though I take an empirical view toward it, that is, we don't have to believe a whole lot about the world. We can simply do these practices and discover that we're changed by them and enact what is obviously healthy. But to care about how that registers in our inner life seems an important obligation, and the disregard of the interior world is that I often do see among some less inspiring atheists. Well, you know, I feel that's important to critique.
Yeah, I want to make sure that I appreciate what you said. I want to make sure that I'm not misunderstood, because I am certainly in no way denigrating or putting down or lessening the importance of developing a rich attention to the quality of our inner life, the quality of our consciousness, our feeling state, our emotions, our inner world. I am, however, wanting to lift up things that don't often get lifted up in many religious and spiritual conversations. For example, the profound spiritual practice of getting really good at interpreting life generously. I mean, the most, or interpreting life in ways that serve you and others. Most people have no understanding of this essential aspect of human nature, that we're social creatures, that we're social animals, and that we're by nature interpretive animals, that we are always interpreting, we're always meaning making. That's what humans do. And that there's no one interpretation or no one meaning to something, but that doesn't mean that we can avoid the task of meaning making or interpretation. And so if religious people, for example, I mean, I've done a lot of, you know, I pastored, you know, 3 churches over the course of a decade, and have also been a personal coach. And so I've been involved in sort of coaching people and pastoral counseling and stuff like that for a long time. And a lot, I would say that if there were one skill that I wish I could impart to people most, especially young people, it would be the skill of learning to interpret life, their own innate capacity, exercising that to interpret life in a way that serves them and others. Because as you, I'm sure, know, the primary determinant of the quality of your life isn't what happens to you, nor is it the number of transcendent experiences that you have. The primary determinant of the quality of your entire life is how you interpret life. It's the meaning making that you give. It's not what happens to you. It's how you interpret what happens to you. And so, for young people and for spiritual people to take as part of their spiritual practice the recognition that there's always more than one depressing way to interpret something, and there's always more than one inspiring way to interpret something. And so, why not choose an interpretation that serves you and serves others, so that we're interpreting generously rather than stingy? And so, I want to make sure that I'm not, you know, sort of lumped in the camp of those who are only focusing. In fact, I reject the term materialist or materialism, because Connie and I are emergentists. That, in fact, many people who used to get painted with the brush of materialism, I think it's inaccurate, because most of us are emergentists. That is, we value emergence, and emergence is mystical. Emergence is natural, but it's also utterly awesome, you know, that hydrogen and oxygen come together and water's created, and you couldn't have possibly predicted that. And throughout the entire history, this is one of the great things about big history, is we see emergence, greater complexity, greater interdependence, and greater cooperation emerging over time. And so, I guess I don't know where I'm going on that, because I've got a couple of threads going at the same time. But I certainly encourage people to continue with whatever spiritual practice nourishes their heart and their soul and their mind, but also to develop sort of to take on as also part of their spiritual practice learning about big history. I mean, for example, there's a little 100-page book called This Fleeting World by David Christian. David Christian is probably the world's leading, or certainly one of the world's leading big historians. In fact, if you want to know what Bill Gates thinks about David Christian and his big history course that's put out by the teaching company, you can just put Bill Gates big history in Google, and there's a little 6-minute video clip, a YouTube clip, that Bill Gates is just raving. He thinks that everybody on the planet needs to learn big history, because it is our common creation story. So I think spiritual people would do well to learn big history, to learn about death. If they go to our great story site and just go to the great story and click on Death Through Deep Time Eyes, there's all kinds of great stuff. It's all for free. It's where people can really learn deeply and feel it in their bones and have a different relationship, so they can honor death and then have their own mortality as their friend, so that that causes them to live their life differently. And then also with respect to this honoring of time that sometimes gets lost in spiritual communities.
Well, I want to underline your endorsement of David Christian's work. I've so enjoyed his teaching company course. It's wonderful in many ways, and yet in some ways there are aspects of what I find in the great story that he doesn't touch on, and I'm so glad there are a richer and wider range of resources, some of which are more spiritual in nature, such as Barbara Marx Hubbard's work or Craig's, or even my own way of interpreting it. And your work carries a quality of emotion and feeling and inspiration and passion that, although I wouldn't call David Christian's disposition colorless or dead, I think you bring a lot more juice to it, Michael.
And... Oh, absolutely. Well, absolutely. And all the people you just named, as well as, you know, Dwayne Elgin and a whole bunch of others,
yes,
are taking big history, they're taking the epic of evolution, and then showing people of all different religious and non-religious backgrounds how sacred, how meaningful, how inspiring, how juicy, how like, whoa, isn't this awesome? It is. But that's not David Christian's role. David Christian is an academic big historian, and, you know, they're just trying to focus in terms of, like, some of the courses and books that have been written on big history. They're less focusing on how can this be interpreted than simply what's the evidence? What's our best scientific, historic, and cross-cultural evidence about the nature of reality? And so I don't fault them for not getting into that, nor am I hearing that at you. But I again, they're playing a different role, a vital role in the body of life. But I'm hugely grateful for all the people you mentioned, as well as a whole lot of others who
yes,
are taking
a whole lot of others,
history,
right? Yeah.
You know, taking the epic of evolution and then showing people, yes, this is our common creation story. This can excite us to move into the future in a service-oriented way. You know, where there's an exercise that Connie and I have been using for years, where we invite people to take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, so they've got two columns. And on the right-hand side, list all the activities, the projects, the things that you love to do that light you up, that give you joy, that give you a sense of energy and fulfillment and happiness, you know, things that you're good at, things other people tell you that you're good at, et cetera. You list it all. It can be 2 or 3 pages. And at the top of that list, you put my great joy. And then on the other side of the paper, you list all the things that you feel, not just where you intellectually know about what the world's needs are, but where do you feel it? Where does it hit you? Where do you get frustrated or upset or depressed? And especially, where do you feel compassion? Where does your heart just break open with compassion for what's happening in the world or in your community? And you list all that stuff. And then you just pay attention to your heart. You just pay attention. You don't have to call it prayer or meditation if you don't want to, or you can. But you just pay attention to the center of your chest and ask guidance from right there. And what you're trying to do is basically play mix and match. Like, where are the intersections between what lights you up, what gives you joy, what gives you energy, and what the world's needs are or your community's needs as you feel them? And those places of intersection where your joy and the world's needs intersect, that's your calling. That's your mission. That's your vocation. You know, that's where you can be the growing edge of what God or the goddess or the universe or revolution is up to. And whether you can make money at it or not is completely irrelevant. If you take one step a month in the direction of where your joy and the world's needs intersect, it will nourish you at the depths of your being. And I think that's why we need a whole lot of us that are storytellers, the poets, the artists, the musicians, the, you know, all the various art forms to take this epic of evolution, to take this common creation story, this science-based evidential understanding of big history, and then show people of all different stripes and backgrounds and colors that this is our common story that can unite us, that can excite us, and that can help us cooperate so that we truly can co-create a just, healthy, and sustainably life-giving future for not just humanity, but the larger body of life of which we're a part.
Beautifully, beautifully put, Michael. You're such an eloquent fellow. I always enjoy your elegant phrasing of such important and essential things. It's great to hear all that. One of the things that I want to kind of point out to you, just kind of in closing, is that you know, at first I don't think I saw the practice side of your work. I saw it as an educational work that had to do about understanding the world and understanding mm-hmm. our history. But the more I get to know you and more deeply explore how you relate to this, one of the things, you know, I've devoted my focus of my work for several years on the importance of a daily practice, because the difference between a life of intention that cares to cultivate one's best and the life of someone who simply is turned outward only to meet the demands and needs of life and doesn't have that sense of cultivation, that's huge. That is the biggest dividing line. People who take on a disposition of practice and a sense of connection to something larger than themselves are the most different from others of any particular group I know. Now, there are people who don't call their practice a practice, people who are practitioners without calling it a practice, but that seems so central, and it took me a while to see how much you do emphasize and embody that in your own work, and I just want to give you a chance to comment on that.
Well, first of all, I thank you for saying that, because you're right. Spiritual practice is the way it's referred to in spiritual or religious communities, can also be referred to as habit building, skill building in terms of living in deepest integrity, living in big integrity, that is right relationship to reality. And all of the exercises and practices that lead a person to honor their own inner nature and to honor the nature of others, and to honor time, to befriend time, to live with their own mortality as a gift that inspires them to live in deeper integrity. All the practices that help us, that lead us to more thriving relationships so that we're reconciled to people that we used to be close to but we're no longer close to, all of those are spiritual practices. And Connie and I, yeah, well, actually, before I even say that, I mean, we all know spiritual tradition, spiritual teachers, religious leaders, megachurch pastors, gurus, priests, you know, that have succumbed to sexual scandal, or, you know, so-called enlightened individuals that have really lousy relationships with their own immediate family members, and on and on and on. There's a practical spirituality. There's an evidential, you know, everything that allows us and helps us to grow, because it's not about perfection. It's just growing in right relationship to reality, such that we can very quickly get to the place where we have no secrets, we have no resentments, we have no unfinished business, and that we would judge the quality of our own lives at an 8 to 10 on a scale of 10, and all the people that we're in relationship with, all, you know, our parents, our siblings, our children, our coworkers, you know, the people that we have to interact with in any capacity, that they would rate the quality of their relationship to us as an 8 to 10. That's possible, and the work, the skill building that helps us get there, the exercises that help us get there, so that we look at our life and we feel that, my God, we're in heaven, and that we're then free because we realize we're not trying to perfect ourselves before we can be of service to the world. I mean, you know, one of the most freeing understandings that we get from this evidential perspective is that the universe needs our imperfections. You know, the things that you're trying to, you know, perfect before you get to work in the world, give it up. The universe needs those, you know. And so Connie and I actually have a little 5-week crash course that we're going to be creating coming out in May, and then probably in June a longer 6-month course. The little short one is going to be called Evolutionize Your Hopes and Fears, The Science of Living a Mythic, Meaningful Life. And then the tagline is a 5-week crash course in how to thrive no matter what. And then the 6-month course will be called Evolutionize Your Life, the science of personal and relational transformation. And that's really where we get into the habit building. And again, it's not in competition with what you're doing or what Craig's doing or what, you know, any of the other spiritual leaders are out there doing. It's basically sort of what's our best evidential understanding of how to thrive in right relationship to reality, so that then when we pursue whatever spiritual or metaphysical path, it's enriched profoundly by our best evidential honoring of time, death, and nature. But anyway, thanks for asking that question.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you. You know, we could probably keep going all day, but I've seen some really lovely questions come in from Instant Teleseminar window, and I want to let everybody know, if you do have a question for Michael or for me, you can type that in if you're listening via computer in the Instant Teleseminar window on your computer. But if you've dialed in by phone, if you press *2 on your keypad, that will raise your hand. And please know, if you press it twice, it'll lower your hand. It's kind of a toggle. So just press it once, or if you've pressed it a second time, press it a third. So I also want to tell you about the online dialogue series that Michael created, which consists of over 40 interviews and panel discussions. It's focused on this work he's doing in the context of Christianity specifically. It's called The Advent of Evolutionary Christianity, Conversations at the Leading Edge of Faith, and it features Michael in conversation with 38 preachers, thought leaders, scientists who are at the leading edge of science and religion. And his guests include 2 Nobel Prize-winning scientists, 3 Templeton Prize winners, and 24 other brilliant individuals who exemplify in word and deed that traditional religion, specifically Christianity, is actually strengthened and enriched when it embraces a science-honoring and evidence-based evolutionary view of life and the world. You can access it for free online at evolutionarychristianity.com. And he has a blog there, evolutionarychristianity.com/blog. I also want to make sure that you're aware of my new online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, which will open its first session to the folks enrolled this Thursday, March 24th. So there's still time for you to become a part of what's going to be a pretty amazing journey. This original cohort of people will be joining me in engaging a unique transformative experience. Integral spiritual practice is unique in many ways. One is that it's truly a post-metaphysical approach. That is, if you do certain things, you get certain results. And we really rooted this in an examination of the ancient practices of wisdom traditions of all cultures, but also the findings of modern science and even some of the insights of postmodern psychology, and brought them together in a very highly streamlined and efficient and simplified form that's entirely heartfelt and easy to practice in the midst of a busy life. So it's deeply grounded in the most profound and radical wisdoms of the world's most highly awakened spiritual realizations, but it's also a high-efficiency contemporary path that you can actually practically enact, and it's doable because it's flexible and high efficiency. And it's an unprecedentedly rich resource of professionally produced audios with inspiring and spiritually potent music, videos, studio recordings that you can watch and listen to and practice with, and a rich community and personal guidance from me. So it's both profound and high efficiency. You know, there's a paradox because on some levels, spiritual practice is all of life, and the purpose that you bring to life and the feeling and the understanding of who you are and what life is about, meaning, and that's really the core. But the paradox is that actual doing of practice, this is why people who have meditated every day do change and become different, why people who do a regular practice are transformed. Bringing those together in an approach that both emphasizes the daily practice and that the whole life is practice, I think we've found a way to do that in this course that's unique and potent and effective. So you can find out about that if you go to ispcourse.com. And you can also, if you're interested to get into it a little bit more deeply than you can get on that website, ispcourse.com, you can email integralspiritualpractice@evolvingwisdom.com and ask for the link to the question and answer session that I broadcast this past Wednesday. Or just go to ispcourse.com. Also, please stay on the line, and at the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. Dr. Roger Walsh will be with me in 2 weeks on April 3rd. Then Candace O'Denver on April 17th. She's wonderful if you haven't met her before. Andrew Harvey will be with us on Mother's Day, May 12th. And then later, A.H. Almas, also known as Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School. And then at the very end of this call, we'll open up the line so that we can hear some of each other's voices and say goodbye. So let's get to the question and answer section of today's dialogue. Let's see. We have... we've got some hands up and some amazing questions over the Instant Teleseminar window, Michael. One of them, Ruth Newman from Louisville, Kentucky, asks, how do we begin creating inroads and practical structures for dialogue with folks who don't believe in an evidential approach to life or a right relationship to reality? We're also culturally, politically, and geographically segregated. Is there a way of developing a language or a protocol of unity and humility that could begin to create lines of trust?
Wow, that's a great question.
Isn't it?
Part of what I've tried to do with my evolutionary Christianity, I mean, anybody, you know, if anybody listening to this call has a Christian, you know, either if you're a Christian yourself of any kind, or if you have any Christians in your life, whether they be conservative, moderate, liberal, radical, whatever, I certainly recommend that you send them to evolutionarychristianity.com. And part of that is just because there's 38 amazing one-on-one conversations that Connie, my wife, edited. So they're tight. They're really great. And each one is just stunning in terms of I find it hard to think that anybody who's a Christian could listen to even more than a handful of those and not be deeply moved, because they're not just intellectual. They're very heartful, most of them. But to answer the question more directly, I mean, when people sometimes ask me, like, how do you relate to fundamentalists and those who completely reject science or reject evolution? And my honest response is that I just love them. I don't try to convert them. I don't try to fix them. I don't try to tell them that I'm wrong or that they're wrong. I just love and accept them exactly as they are and exactly as they're not. And if I'm effective in doing that, which frankly I've gotten pretty good at doing over the years, they don't have anything. There's no defensiveness. They don't defend themselves because I'm not attacking anything. If they go to their grave thinking exactly as they do, that's fine with me. But because I don't have any energy towards like making them wrong or converting them or convincing them that I'm right and they're wrong, if they stay in relationship with me for any length of time at all, they usually get curious. And so then there's a receptivity on their end to hear why I have an evidential, non-supernaturalist perspective that totally lights me up and that inspires me to be of service in the world and inspires me to live in deepest integrity, and they can see the joy in my life. And so, you know, but I'm also grateful for the P.Z. Myerses and the Richard Dawkins and the people who are slamming, you know, supernatural otherworldlyism, because I think we need a whole diversity of approaches. So I'm not saying that everybody should have my approach, but that is what I've found to be most effective in dealing with the people in my life who don't embrace an evolutionary worldview or who don't embrace an ecological worldview.
That's beautiful. One of our other questions on the Instant Teleseminar window, this one from Alex Suarez in Seattle, kind of takes the same topic a little further. He says, science has become more and more restrictive about what it accepts as evidence, the double-blind, randomized control group as the golden standard, and fundamentalist religions are becoming more and more restrictive about what they accept as evidence, revelation, the voice of tradition, church authority. The problem isn't really the content of the map of reality, but rather how we learn and what we accept as evidence. Do you see any direct way of bridging that gap? How does your work actually help that gap to be bridged?
Well, part of it, Terry, is that I, you know, what Connie and I try to do in every presentation that we deliver on our websites and everything else, our traveling ministry, is that we try to show people that what science really is humanity's collective intelligence, that science, you know, the worldwide self-correcting scientific enterprise has gone through a process over hundreds of years, actually thousands of years if you include the ancient Greeks, in terms of trying to help us as a species discern, is this statement true or is this understanding true in a measurable empirical sense? That is it true in a way that all of us, whether we're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, or atheist, can agree it's true? Or is it merely said to be true because some charismatic or authoritative person said so, or because it's been passed down for so many generations by tradition that we assume it must be true? And that narrowing of what gets counted as evidence, I count as a really good thing, because, in fact, I've got in I think, chapter 5 of my book, I have a history that I got from Kevin Kelly from Wired Magazine. I've got a history of how we've gotten better and better at sort of helping us come to an understanding of the kind of truth that really counts as global collective intelligence. It's not tribal collective intelligence. It's not regional or ethnic collective intelligence. It's now global collective intelligence. In other words, it's what we can say confidently that we know that Christian scientists, Buddhist scientists, atheist scientists, Jewish scientists, all different kinds of scientists, no matter what their background, we all agree, yes, this is evidentially the case. That's part of what big history is about. And so the more that religious people can really embrace that as sacred, as you know, I mean, the way I speak about it when I speak in Christian circles is I say evidence is the main way that God, that is reality, is speaking today. That to value the Bible over scientific, historic, and cross-cultural evidence is to diss God. It's to trivialize God. It's basically saying that God communicated all the cool, important, vital stuff 2,000 or 3,000 years ago when people believed the world was flat and, you know, religious insights were recorded on animal skins. That, you know, when I speak to Christians, I say facts are God's native tongue. And so I think we're in the early stages of an evidential reformation. You know, you had the prior to the Protestant Reformation, the Christian church, it was one church, really valued tradition and hierarchy. And then the Protestants come along and they say, no, solo scriptura, only the Bible, which ended up, you know, we can now see was sort of making an idol of the Bible, you know, as these words are God's ultimate and only important communication. And what we're now in the early stages, I think, is of a evidential reformation where we start seeing cross-cultural, scientific, and historic evidence as divine communication, as divine guidance. And I think that we're going to see an explosive transformation of traditional religion as it not just as it stops resisting science but wholeheartedly embraces it. I think we're going from unconscious mythic mindset, where we were unconsciously mythic. That is, we had a relational understanding of reality, but it was unconscious. And then we went, and then that's our childhood as a species. And then in our adolescence as a species, which we're still in the midst of, is a conscious anti-myth, anti-mythic or anti-relational. We're poo-pooing all the mythic and religious stuff. And I think what we're moving into as an adult and as a species is being consciously mythic or consciously relational. It's like, yes, as you said at the start with your introduction to me, Connie and I have personified North America as Nora. So we've got this intimate personal relationship with Nora, but it's a conscious mythic. It's conscious relational. We don't actually believe that there's a consciousness, Nora, that's like ours and that's, you know, conspiring on our behalf. But it's playful. It's yummy. It's nurturing. It's kind of like when we use the word God. When I use the word God, it's an interpretive stance toward reality. It's kind of like saying, I trust the universe. I don't believe the universe has a consciousness like mine and yours, and that it's inspiring on my behalf. It's just having a I trust the universe stance toward reality is useful. It's pragmatic. It's like I love my life when I trust that the chaos and challenges of my life aren't a cosmic mistake, you know. And so so Connie and I often throughout the day, many times in the day, we laugh. At, you know, we got all kinds of really what we call just practices of goofiness. We got this goofy stuff that we do all day long that, you know, that keeps us in a light, playful way. And one of the things we say to ourselves a dozen or two dozen times a day sometimes is, oh, the Lord be blessing us. And what we mean is that life is amazing. Isn't this incredible life? So anyway, sorry I took so long on that one.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, but I do want to get more of these questions. We've got quite a few great ones. Yeah. Jose Fuentes from Bogota, Colombia, asks us to discuss the apparent contradiction between the obvious value in accepting things exactly as they are as part of what's necessary to stop suffering, but also then, of course, acting on the problems of our world to stop suffering.
Yeah, that's such a vital point, because sometimes people get the mistaken idea that trusting the universe just means kicking back and not doing anything. It's just sort of accepting everything exactly as it is and exactly as it's not, and then you're not engaged to be in action. No, trusting the universe means trusting your feelings, trusting your anger, trusting your sense of injustice when you see injustice, trusting the compassion that you feel for others in the world and other species, and that those trusting the universe means trusting those feelings to propel you to be in action, so that we are spiritual activists or non-spiritual activists, but we're simply being about helping to co-create a healthy, sustainably life-giving future from a place of trusting that our feelings are how the universe guides us, you know, to use that more sort of relational language.
Great. Well, there's a lot of rich questions here from all over the world. There's one that I want to make sure to bring you. Lisa from Colombia asks, she said a key concept for people of most faith traditions is the way that the afterlife is tied to the idea of justice, that there is some justice, and that this life isn't fair, but there's more than just this life, and that there is a kind of larger frame that has justice. And this is often tied to people's personal experience of the meaning of their lives, so that people have guidance as to how to make good choices and what their consequences are and why things happen to us, particularly bad things. And how does this concept of justice live in your beliefs about evolutionary spirituality?
Wow. Awesome question. Well, I guess the short version would be I'm a one-story kind of guy. I used to be a two-story person. I used to have a two-story worldview. There was the natural world, the physical world, and then there was this supernatural world, the metaphysical world. And I no longer have that. Now I interpret all metaphysical language, all spiritual language, all so-called supernatural language as being about our interpretation of the one universe, the one reality, which is you know, not just everything we can know, think, and imagine, everything we can measure and know, but also everything that we, you know, that transcends whatever we can know, think, or imagine. And so having being a one-story person, and that's both in terms of sort of a one-story house rather than a two-story house, but also one story in a big history interpreted meaningfully, the great story, is my sacred story. And so I, as a religious naturalist, I think that things aren't always fair. And I don't hold out hope that really, really bad people sort of get their, you know, get their due in an afterlife. I just don't see any evidence for that at all. It seems to me, and again, I feel free to reject this, anybody listening, but for me, as a religious naturalist, it seems to me that where we go to when we die is the same place where we came from before we were born. And some people refer to that as coming from God and returning to God, or coming from mystery and returning to mystery, or coming from nothingness and returning to nothingness. You can speak about it in different ways, but to my mind, that's what's real. That's what we have evidence for, and that all of our mystical and spiritual and transcendent thinking about that is all rich and cool and wonderful. But I think we go to the same place that all other animals and plants and bacteria and everything else have gone to when they've died. And it's back with the one, back with the ultimate. And, you know, you can talk about that in mythic night language ways, or just, you know, in terms of we're gone. But I don't see evidence that there's some kind of a otherworldly or afterlife existence that sort of fulfills that human desire for justice in an ultimate sense. I just don't see any evidence of that. But that's kind of.
Thank you, Michael. Well, here's a question that seems to be maybe for me. Marcia from Scranton, Pennsylvania asks, it seems that some people need help to strengthen their practice, and other people need help to do work in the world to evolve into the best that they can be. And I think what she's pointing to, thank you, Marcia, is the fact that some of us default to a position in which whatever comes up, we go inward with it, we reflect, we look at changing ourselves. And other people just chronically always go into action mode. What do I do? And they broadcast their energies outward. And either of those can become a kind of static mode that represents a kind of fixity. And an aspect of practice is opening out of that fixity, so that if you're always going inward and always working inside, there's a need to bring your energy outward. And if you're always going outward, you need to actually work with your own interiors too. And that's one of the many expressions of the kind of both and nature of an integral approach to practice. And there are many ways that a balanced spiritual practice is gonna help you do that. One of the core ones is, I think, expressed in this whole nature of this series of dialogues, is that we have responsibilities right now as planetary citizens, and finding ways to transform ourselves in our interiors always has to find its application in how we act in the world.
There's something I think that's really important that's raised by that question that comes back to something we discussed earlier, which is, without an evidential, science-based understanding of our brains, our inherited proclivities, we're going to be clueless to the fact that there are at least 24 different ways that we now know scientifically, there's just no debate about, that we deceive ourselves. And that we're really good at doing that. And so that's one of the dangers I see of traditional spiritual practice that doesn't embrace an evidential understanding, is because we can be avoiding the real work of how to really have an amazing life, because we're just doing all this inner stuff, and we're going to be clueless. And it's one of the things that's going to allow for situations where, you know, people who are spiritual leaders, enlightened leaders, you know, do immoral things or fall victim to sexual scandal or whatever. And part of that is because we are supremely excellent at deceiving ourselves. And we're not going to even have an evolutionary witness of how that's the case if we don't understand how our brains work. So the way I sometimes speak about it is that big integrity, right relationship to reality, as it really is, not just as you wish it was, isn't a solo sport. It's a team sport. We need each other. It's really relational spirituality. It requires the support of others, the feedback of others. It requires doing and communicating. You know, I can sit and try to witness my feelings to death, you know, to witness my uncomfortable emotions to death, my guilt, my resentment. But, you know, there's science-based understandings that if I just write a letter of gratitude, a letter of forgiveness, if I tell that person that, you know, I'm really sorry that I betrayed you 8 years ago and I've never told you that I'm sorry, boom, the guilt's gone. But the guilt's gone not because we witnessed it to death. It's because we actually did something in the world. We had a communication with that person. And so that's where I sort of I want to come back to sort of the practical spirituality or the relational spirituality. That if all we do is think of spirituality as the inner thing, if we kind of have this duality, there's the spirituality, which is all the inner stuff, and then there's activism, all the outer stuff. I think that's a false dichotomy. I think that some of the most powerful spiritual things that we can do are confess our secrets, are clean up our past, which we can do joyfully once we no longer have self-judgment about our past. We recognize, oh, of course I said that or did that back then. It's like that's what my instincts do. They lead me to do that, you know, and that's why this lightness, this playfulness, this acceptance, this gratitude, I guess is the best word, a gratitude that can only come from an evolutionary understanding is so vital, because otherwise we can work on ourselves and meditate till we are blue in the face and we're still going to struggle with some of the same stuff because our brains are really good at deceiving ourselves. We are programmed to do that.
Yes, very important. That's something that I work with my students all the time. Not so much always focusing on the evolutionary story, but working with the inner process of having an ability to be self-skeptical and still able to stand with the strength of the truths that we do best understand. And being able to really stand with force and integrity in what is clear, and also be deeply self-skeptical about our shadow, about our structures of meaning making that perhaps it's time for us to outgrow. That is a deep yoga. It really requires you to be very present and to show up with a great deal of humility and a great deal of courage, not defaulting always into doubting your own meaning making, but not only standing in certainty, but really sensing in the moment when it's time to open, when it's time to stand firm.
Amen. Amen. And it really develops. It's about the yoga of integrity. It's the practices that lead us to be in right relationship to ourselves, to our own deep nature, to our evolutionary past, to the future, to our own death, and so on. And, you know, big mind without big integrity is potentially pernicious. I mean, integral thinking, integral philosophy without integrous habits can sometimes do more harm than good. It's why one of the things I really am encouraged by is those within the integral community, those within the enlightenment community, those within the spiritual communities, those within the Christian traditions of Christian spirituality that are in no way putting down or turning their backs on their tradition, but are really embracing a more evidential, integrity-based understanding and integrating that. Because, you know, frankly, I'd rather hang out with atheists who are living in deep integrity, or non-religious people who are living in deep integrity, then because we're operating out of an accurate map of reality, an accurate map of death, time, and nature, then I would hang around deeply spiritual people who are clueless about what's going on under the hood, because they're so focused on the metaphysical, they're so focused on the supernatural that's what's most important to them, that they're ignoring or not attending to in a mindful, heartful way the basic, just core level patterns, the core level habits, the core level communication tools that allow us to really have a meaningful, mythic life and to have thriving relationships, and frankly to be able to die a peaceful, serene death, and to know that we're leaving a sweet, sweet legacy. And that comes from the habits that can develop sort of spiritual habits of integrity, not just spiritual habits of meditation or scripture reading or, you know, sort of more traditional sort of thing.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that. We're kind of at the end of our time, but we've got a whole rich group of questions that I haven't been able to get to. I do want to ask one more. Theodore, let's see, Dara Aneanu, I think, maybe, from Bucharest, Romania. What he typed is simple, but maybe I can unpack it. He says, isn't it too much to link religion to an integral life? The religious domain is mutually exclusive with the scientific domain, at least it appears to be to me. And I think what he's kind of saying, having just typed in this question relatively recently, might be, you know, are you really linking those in a genuine way that finds authentic, deep, common ground in your work, Michael? Or to some, in what respects are you kind of sweeping these differences under the rug, or finding points of linkage, but not being able to resolve these fundamental differences? You know, is it to what degree is the common ground that you're able to bring to Christians and skeptics superficial, and to what degree is it essential? Where do you really find that common ground in a way that really is authentic?
Yeah, the only common ground, which is really the heart of what Connie and I have been doing for 9 years on the road, is our best evidential understanding of time, nature, and death, our best evidential understanding of the universe and humans and our role in the universe. And that the idea that religion and science are two totally separate domains is only true if you interpret religion as supernatural otherworldlyism. If what you interpret as religion is beliefs in afterlife, other world, supernatural kinds of things taken literally, well, then yes, they're obviously incompatible. But I'm a religious naturalist. I'm a profoundly religious person. I don't have any religious beliefs whatsoever. My religious orientation is grounded in our best evidential understanding of reality. And so from my vantage point, the way I understand religion is that religion, religio, is about that impulse within the human to interpret and to relate in a meaningful way to reality. And that reality has been personified in different cultures in different ways. In fact, we don't know of any culture anywhere in the world that either reality as a whole or some significant aspect of reality hasn't been personified. That's one of the reasons why you've got so many different gods and goddesses all over the world. These are not, God isn't a person. God's a personification. God's a relational stance toward reality. And that only when we can embrace that kind of a wide understanding that, oh, people are using so-called supernatural language, but it's mythic language. It's pre-natural. So, no, I don't see the two as in competition because I'm a profoundly religious person, but my religion is grounded in our best evidential understanding. And, frankly, I think that there will be millions of us. I see several main trends in the 21st century religiously. I think we're going to continue to see the growth of those who consider themselves non-religious. The atheists, humanists, secularists, skeptics, non-religious people. I think that the numbers of people that qualify and that see themselves as that will continue to grow. I think we're also going to see the continued growth of religious naturalists within. There's Catholics, Protestants, Baptists, Buddhists, you know, all different religious people who are no longer supernaturalists. They're naturalists. In other words, they interpret the mythic language or their traditional language or their creeds or their doctrines in a one-story way, not a two-story way. And I think we're going to continue to see the explosive growth of that. And I think we are going to see the lessening, the shrinking of traditional otherworldly forms of religion where it's all about the afterlife, that's the only thing that really matters, and that this world can go to hell because, you know, hey, that's what matters. That's going to continue to shrink. It's going to take longer in the third world, but that's already shrinking. I mean, it's shrunk hugely in Europe. It's shrinking fast in the United States, and I think that will continue.
Well, thank you, Michael. I really want to keep this going, especially because we have so many rich questions that we still haven't had a chance to get to. I want to say to all of you who've typed in questions that I haven't gotten to, I really wish that I had time to get there. What I will do is copy all these questions into an email and send them to Michael. And if the problem is, you see, we don't have your email addresses. So if you want to be in contact with Michael or me, you'd need to sign up on the mailing lists on either maybe would you want them to go to thegreatstory.com, Michael? Sign up the mailing list there.
I don't know that we've got a sign up there. I think we've got a sign up form on evolutionary Christianity. So just go to have anybody who wants to sort of be in communication with me around any of this, even if it's got nothing to do with Christianity, I would say go to the evolutionarychristianity.com website and then just put your name and email address there.
Okay, great. And then they can email you through that.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that I'd be willing to do, that I'd be happy to do, is if you send me the questions that people have had that we didn't get a chance to get to, I can sit down at my computer and just, you know, create an MP3. I can just talk into GarageBand and I can record a response to those and then simply send you the link to the MP3 so that you can let folks know through your circles. I mean, however you want to do it, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, we can probably do something like that. We can post that as a comment on the announcement of this talk. If you send that MP3, we can post we might need you to host it somewhere in order to have a link. Rather, I'm not sure we can put the file
easy,
there.
Right?
We could do it. I think
we can do websites.
It.
We can do that. Great.
Terrific. Yeah. And if you have questions for me, please go to terrypatton.com or integralspiritualpractice.com, and you can sign up on my mailing list, my personal mailing list there. Some of these questions were for me as well. Well, thank you, everybody. My course on integral spiritual practice will open this Thursday. Please check that out at ispcourse.com, or if you want to find more information about that, you can email integralspiritualpractice@evolvingwisdom.com and ask for a link to the Q&A broadcast I did last Wednesday. Also, I want to let people know about the dynamics of change. All coaches, change agents, and consultants, this new free speaker series explores the core conditions that create lasting and embodied personal growth and transformation, and it features some of the world's leading experts in the fields of personal and collective transformation, including Robert Keegan, Terry O'Fallon, Craig Hamilton, and me, Terry Patton, and many more. So take your personal growth and your work in transforming others to the next level by signing up for free at coachesrising.com, coachesrising.com. And then coming up here on Beyond Awakening on April 3rd, I'll be speaking with the really brilliant scholar and psychologist Roger Walsh about the psychological and spiritual roots of survival, essentially. And we'll be announcing that shortly. Then on April 17th, I'll be talking with great freedom teacher Candace O'Denver. And then on Mother's Day, May 12th, I'll be interviewing the brilliant mystical poet Andrew Harvey on the sacred feminine and on sacred activism. And there's much more to come. So now let's open up our phone lines. For those of us who are still here, we can all hear each other's voices at least for a moment and say goodbye. So goodbye, everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Bye. Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Love globally.
Bless
love. Everyone all over the world infinitely.